Welcome to the iTech Forum podcast. I'm Richard Bennett, and this week my guest is Henning Schulzrinne, former chief technologist at the FCC, a Columbia University tenured professor in computer science and electrical engineering. I'm one of the principal architects of the Internet Engineering Task Force's work on voice over IP. Hello, Henning.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. So, Henning, you're the second chief technologist I interviewed, and hopefully, in the fullness of time, I'll get to all the living ones. And the first one I did was Dave Farber, and we got into a pretty interesting conversation about his background and what led him to develop his interest in computers and networking. So, just for the sake of consistency, how did you gravitate towards this direction?
It's actually, I guess, slightly unusual. I was an exchange student at in Livermore, California.
Where I used to live. Yeah, great town.
Yeah, and so my host father was, at the time, he's long retired, a nuclear physicist at Lawrence Livermore Lab. And so he was interested in computing because he did simulations. And I had a host uncle who was a mathematics teacher at a high school in Marin County. And I spent some time with him and ended up building an electronics kit for one of the early computers. So they're going to be Alto type of computers, as I learned soldering.
Oh, okay.
I had done radio electronics as a student before, just like many my boys did at the time. Mm-hmm. Kind of tube kits. I still had a one tube and a pentode where you would build an AM radio. Mm-hmm. But that was really the first time I'd been exposed to real computers. That was in the late 70s. It was in Livermore in 78, 79. And high school had one of the first PET computers, among others. And I had a dial-up connection to a Lawrence Livermore Lab computer.
Well, and Lawrence Livermore was one of the original internet sites.
Original internet sites. I didn't deal with any internet things there. And we actually at home, for my host father, he had a teletype at home. Mm. So he provided access to his account. So I actually learned programming, Fortran programming, using one of these clunky teletype monsters that sat in the kitchen and rattled the whole house when you'd had it going.
Oh, yeah.
And you had to have a line editor where you typed in your Fortran program. So depending on what day of the week it was, I would either type a program on a CDC 10 or on, if I got lucky, they had one of the first Crays. Essentially learned my beginning sorting algorithms for Fortran on a lab computer, and then they had a computing class at the Livermore High School as well.
Well, that's pretty amazing. You're just an innocent kid from Germany. You come over to the U.S. and you're exposed to all these mad scientists and engineers and some of the most state-of-the-art computers in the world.
It's just complete coincidence.
Just hooked up at home, you know. Yeah. You really had no choice.
Exactly. And then I continued on in engineering in Germany at a university and then trained.
I wonder, it may be the case that Livermore High, the famous Cowboys, that may be the only high school in America that's produced a Hall of Fame baseball player and an FCC chief technologist.
That would be an interesting...
I'll have to check that out. After Livermore High, you went to university, I guess, in the U.S. and
first in Germany and in Darmstadt, and then in U.S. in Cincinnati and UMass Amherst.
Yeah, and I know you most for your contributions in voice over IP. Was this something that you that developed like fairly soon after?
Yeah, it was an interesting, gradual transition. In Cincinnati, I worked in a digital signal processing lab and did voice coding, vector quantization for voice and video. So we had the first kind of PDP-11, early PDP-11 systems that had a digital analog to digital converter built in. And so I did.
So this would have been late 70s, early 80s?
Early 80s.
Yeah.
And at the time I got interested in networking, because we didn't, UC wasn't the most up-to-date campus, so I strung Ethernet after hours so that unionized labor wouldn't harass us, as in we were violating union rules. Yellow cable Ethernet through the ceiling.
Yeah, that stuff as thick as a garden hose.
Yes,
yeah.
And that was the first...
Goldenrod cable.
The first local area network in the engineering college that we wired up. And so I got interested in networking and went in and my doctorate went to UMass Amherst and ended up in the research group of Don Towsley and Jim Carosi, who are both networking faculty. And so then I used my interest in speech and voice and signal processing. I got connected to the so-called .NET group. This was a DARPA-funded project that built multicast systems over the internet. And at the time, that was also when Van Jacobsen had started and others at Lawrence Berkeley had started some of the voice efforts for like the VAT audio tool, for example. And so I started building audio tools, and when the IETF was in Boston, I just attended my first IETF meeting where we just started the AVT working group, working group for all the multimedia work that was done.
So this stuff sort of moved through a progression, right? I mean, first we figured out how to digitize speech.
Yep.
And how to basically do recording, storage, and retrieval stuff. And then once that was kind of reduced to practice, then the issue of moving speech over networks came to the fore. And first, well, local area networks as a transport for speech were, that was pretty interesting. I mean, it actually motivated a whole lot of work in MAC protocols, because there was this big dispute back then between token ring and Ethernet about, you know, how much control you needed to have in the network and how much we had to make trade-offs in terms of, you only had so many gates that you could put into a chip in those days. So it was a pretty burning question, right, whether you used the gates for raw capacity or whether you used them for control. But even then, I mean, by the early 80s, voice and multimedia was already a really hot research topic,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. It had already started, but primarily in local area networks, when Xerox PARC had done some early work for essentially a voice PBX over Ethernet.
Well, that was actually one of the first research papers that PARC produced once they'd figured, I mean, they... Metcalf and Boggs invented the Ethernet because they had to, because there were all these research ideas that people had backed up that needed a network, right, to carry.
And so they had a very basic voice system that they had built for just local area networks. And then you had two things coming together in terms of making it feasible. Namely, you had Sun workstations that actually for the first time had a built-in audio codec that was not just meant for games. I mean, because many of the PCs that you had if they had a sound card at all, they were designed for playing, they played MIDI sounds, and maybe you could do voice recordings, but they had...
It was pretty rudimentary stuff.
The latency was completely unsuitable for anything real-time. So in that sense, it was when Spark systems came out, really made it possible for researchers to not build their own hardware. They had to do if you look at the early voice experiments, that was all you had to build hardware, like ISI built hardware for voice codecs, and that really meant it wasn't scalable to a larger set of researchers.
And Sun was a great platform for early research on video too, it was a really powerful CPU compared to like PCs.
Yes, and it could be accessed at a fairly low level, so it was possible that it was. for example, audio was just dev/audio. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to do a lot of low-level driver writing. You got an audio stream out of a device, or a video stream as well when that came.
And they were really quick to support FiberNet. Yep. I mean, there are some really, really high capacity networks that you could do. You could do HD. I mean, sort of the idea for HD video, I think, came out as an after effect of the fact that we already had computers that were capable of doing it.
And some of the early Sun systems, more so SGI at the time, but were also used in video production.
Oh, yeah.
In video coding for non-real-time type of coding, content coding. And so they had at least some commercial motivation to support high-quality audio and video content.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there was definitely a market niche for that. When movie production started to go from analog to digital, you needed powerful platforms to do it. And it took a while for all of these, for audio-video stuff, to hit the consumer marketplace, but it's definitely there now. After only took like 20 years or so.
I was at Bell Labs as a postdoc, and not in the telephony group, but I had done some of the work on RTP as transport protocol at the time, and starting to think about signaling, and so I started talking to researchers in Bell Labs, and they said, "Oh, this is all very interesting, but we got a production level, we got an industrial strength, the best voice network anywhere, and it works. We are now talking about improving the voice quality." That was the time when AT&T introduced voice filtering just make it voice sound better. It was still 4 kilohertz voice, but they just made a big deal of adding some filtering to it. And so you go back to your lab and do your packet voice. We don't need that. We got real voice here.
Well, they sort of had a bit of a captive audience.
Yes.
They didn't have to worry too much about. I mean, it seems to me that a lot of the work you've done is on making standards compliant solutions for these kinds of problems. I mean, anybody can basically sit down and make this stuff happen in a proprietary system with where they control all the equipment end to end, but making an open solution that different firms and different innovators can plug pieces into, that's a whole different, it's an order of magnitude more complicated problem.
Yes, particularly initially, many of the applications, if you look at the initial multimedia applications, what people anticipated as kind of a killer application for that was multicast audio and video. So if you look at .NET and the M-Bone as early platforms, it was essentially one-to-many distribution of content, initially NASA's shuttle launches and similar type of, and IETF events, and then if you had revision, educational seminars and so on, but very much essentially a small-scale, what we would call webinars today, too small to be on real TV and too large to be on a phone conference. So really,
well, and it's this is what the internet provides us with, connectivity, and connectivity comes in many forms. It's not all person-to-person, bi-directional, private telephone conversations. I mean, it's also like broadcast TV, but it turns out with TV, the issue is not so much sending the program to everyone in the whole world freely, but sending it to people that for whom it's valuable, and some of them may be willing to pay money for it, maybe in the form of a tuition or just, because the information's super valuable, or just routing it where it needs to go. So M-Bone, that was sort of a kludge, right? Wasn't it?
Yeah, it's applicationally a multicast initially. So you had a set of Sun machines that ran a daemon, MRD, that would essentially replicate packets. It would run an overlay routing protocol, a multicast routing protocol. So it would listen to declarations of interest by end systems. And the novelty at the time was that it was a receiver-based multicast in the sense that a receiver would indicate in a multicast IP address that it cared about, mm-hmm. and that would create implicitly a distribution tree using mm-hmm. those routers.
Yeah.
The problem was that it got too successful for its own good and didn't scale well. So mm-hmm. because people had to provide these routers and somebody had to maintain them and deal with failures.
Oh, and the commercial value proposition behind maintain, I mean, it was sort of like Usenet. I mean, it's something people had to do this freely for it to work, but the incentives were kind of skewed. I mean, in the academic world, I guess the incentives
were run by academic institutions, and once the research value had been exploited, the incentive to maintain the infrastructure wasn't there. Plus, you had to have significant upstream bandwidth because you would get one incoming stream and you would replicate 10 or 20 outgoing streams.
And we do some multicast. I mean, multicast is not M-Bone. It's sort of the follow-on to M-Bone, which is a more of a internet standard multicasting. Is really an essential part of the video services that especially the DSL companies like AT&T and CenturyLink. You know, that's how that stuff works. All those streams, they're all multicast streams. And for the listeners who aren't, you know, immersed in video networking, when a television broadcast tower broadcasts a television show, it sends out basically one copy of the show, and everybody that's interested in the show listens to it. And multicast over the internet is something kind of like that, where there's one unique copy of the program that goes on every link that eventually connects to someone who's interested in watching it, so that it radically reduces the amount of traffic that has to transit the internet in order for a large group of people to watch a television program. I mean, this is why this stuff is important. If Survivor goes to like a Netflix or an Amazon type distribution model, where there's one copy of the program for every viewer.
Yep.
When 50 million Americans are tuned into the same show, it's going to put a lot of stress on some of the internal data lakes and routers that carry internet traffic, and we don't want that.
But particularly when you think of live events like the Super Bowl, or
mm-hmm. Presidential inaugurations,
or these days Republican primary debates.
Well, I don't know that. Even if those are only watched by the families, that's what, like, probably 50 million people. So
yeah,
so many people are running. So you worked in this. You were essentially the initial architect of RTP, right?
With others. So Steve Kasner and Van Jacobson were also uh-huh. heavily involved. So three of us really. When I did a lot of the drafting of the specification and some of the core ideas, but everybody contributed to the document and the discussion.
Well, and this is the way IETF standards typically works, is that there's a small group of people who are interested in a topic, and they'll write an RFC, which used to, in the old days, that used to mean a request for comments, and now it's like not a request for comments. It's essentially a standard. An informational draft that explains an architecture or something like that. But so a small group of people will generate one of these specifications. That's really what it is, an engineering spec. And then people go off and build software, and they build research systems, and in some cases actually build product to it. You find, you know, the shortcomings and the enhancements that people want. You get feedback basically from. This is the whole idea of, like, rough consensus and running code, right?
And at the time, the advantage, in some sense, was that nobody cared.
Mm-hmm.
It was really maybe a handful or two handful of people that had any interest in audio and video over the internet. And that made it possible to do things that probably wouldn't really have been possible if it had been a large commercial effort at that, a large commercial mm-hmm. interest in that. And that's becoming much rarer now in the internet environment, simply because almost any topic of any significance attracts 100 people and large companies, and there's deployed infrastructure you have to worry about.
They all represent nowadays that everybody has a lot of vested economic interests in these areas. Yep. And this is just some, when you're at the early phases of quality of service engineering in networks or multimedia voice, and there's only a handful of people that are interested in it. I mean, it's sort of a pure exercise in research.
Yes, right? It was very much a research to practice transition, where there wasn't really an embedded system or embedded deployed base that we had to worry about. There wasn't an inherent commercial interest in being compatible with something else. And what happened in that case also, that there was a parallel, just like we had in the early internet architecture, where there was a parallel effort between ITU and the internet, or the internet community, namely the ITU at the time was developing a standard for multimedia called HP23, which became for a while and still used the dominant video conferencing standard.
Yeah. Remember that.
And then essentially a parallel effort emerged with somewhat different objectives, which now has become the standard for most video conferencing, most voice PBX systems. But it was very much not the officially blessed version that all the telecom guys were hanging out in Geneva at the ITU doing their ISDN over packet version, which was essentially what HP23 was.
Great quality, but nobody uses it.
Great quality, and it was tied very much. It was meant to be essentially a packet extension of the existing phone network. So it was very much, at the time, there was the effort, I hardly remember it now, called, they had a system called ISDN Integrated Services Digital Network that was meant to be a successor to the analog phone network. So you had...
Well, it actually was in some countries.
In Japan and European countries,
it was
quite successful.
Yeah.
Essentially, but particularly at the commercial level, for business customers as well as residential customers, it was for a decade or so, the dominant voice platform. And indeed, essentially... partially motivated by the fact that Europe never had made the digital transition like the U.S. had in their backbone network. So they essentially leapfrogged the classical T1-style architecture that the U.S. had to the ISDN architecture. Then there was a strong incentive as packet networks came about to integrate packet networks into that. But that turned into a complexity and backward compatibility that you essentially had a system that was far more complex than was necessary, simply because you had to interoperate with signaling system number 7, which is and was the signaling system used for
digital telephone network,
the public switch telephone network.
Yeah. Well, in some countries, the way this played out is that if they had a really horrible analog telephone system, they just skipped digital wireline altogether and just went straight to cell phones.
Yep, later developing countries like India.
Yeah,
and Africa,
I mean, in India, there's a lot of people who the only electronic communication device they have ever used is a cell phone. Yeah, it used to be that 7-year waiting periods to get a telephone line hooked up in India.
I spent some time living in East Germany, working in West Germany, but living on the eastern part after unification, and there we didn't have a telephone system because in East Germany wired telephone was extremely limited.
Well, all the lines went to the KGB, right?
Yeah, KGB or the East German equivalent. And at the time, they didn't have a speech recognition, so they had a finite supply of human listeners, I suppose. And so We didn't have wired voice.
The NSA is so much more efficient.
So you can now do metadata analysis much more readily, at least. So in that sense, we actually had initially a shared payphone out, and this was in the early 90s, and we're not talking 1930s here. In the early 90s, we wanted to make a phone call. You had to line up at a payphone on the outside, and we finally got the early, what you would call a 1G cell phone, analog cell phone, because that was really... So we cut the cord before we ever had a cord, at least in that point. So.
I used to spend some time in India in the late 70s and early 80s, and this is, if you had to call somebody, what you would do is send one of the servants on to take a bus ride to the nearest town that had a post and telegraph office, who would actually go there and stand in line and until his number came up, get access to the telephone, and then make the call for you. So it was a somewhat less than efficient, you know, system. It left a lot to be desired. So you went to the FCC as chief technologist. You were appointed by Chairman Jenikowski?
Yeah, actually, it was slightly more roundabout. I had worked with the FCC on a variety of just as a seminar speaker as well as as panelist, primarily on voice of IP and public safety related issues. And then I had a sabbatical coming up, and I decided that instead of going to industry or another university, which I'd done before, I would knock on the FCC door and see if they had a desk for me. And I told them, hey, you don't have to pay me, the university does, so just find a desk. And I said, sure, well, we do that. We've seen you before. And so after about half a year, when my sabbatical time went in, they said, well, can you stick around? And so then I stuck around as a technology fellow. And then they needed, after Doug Sicker was leaving as my predecessor in the CTO job, they needed a replacement, and I was approached if I was willing to take on that responsibility. And at that point, I'd already gotten to know quite a few of both issues and the people, and so I was able to then essentially just change offices on the same floor, and I had worked on many of the same issues that I continued to work on after changing title.
Well, on the institutional, knowing the culture of the FCC and the way decisions are made and how people collaborate there and the sort of tone and style and culture, I think must have been very helpful.
Yes, and it was quite a surprise initially, because I had not done much policy work. Many of, I think, my predecessors certainly had been fairly active in the telecom policy community of some sort or another.
Your two immediate predecessors were Doug Sicker and John Piha, and they were both, I think, by the time they came to the FCC, they both had strong engineering backgrounds, but had become, I think, more identified anyway with policy thinking than pure engineering.
And I was not that. So when I walked into, on my sabbatical, I had never heard of the Administrative Procedures Act. I had only the faintest of notions what an NPOM might be, and I had no really very little idea how the process works. I had seen some of the output, seen the interactions at workshops, FCC workshops, and these type of events, but not what actually happens to how the machinery works.
So was Bismarck right? You don't want to see sausages made or FCC regulations?
I'd say I was surprised, given the difficulty that you have in that environment, that you're operating in a, in many cases, highly adversarial environment where you have to assume that people are not necessarily telling you the whole story.
Why ain't that the truth?
And where you deal with a huge diversity of issues that you just don't have a classical training for, even if you've had an engineering degree or a law degree.
Well, I think this is one of the disconnects that I think maybe the general public and even the policy community doesn't fully appreciate, is the fact that the FCC has this enormously broad remit, right? I mean, there's the range of issues. I mean, it's easy to say it's all just communications, but communications is everything's communications. I mean, it's the broadest possible field.
And what has changed when I was thinking back a little bit, if I were to transport myself so back into the 1960s and 1970s, well, my communication was always important. TV, radio had always been certainly culturally, politically, economically quite important. It was somewhat insulated from other applications. Radio, really the only application that reached outside, say, the walls of the classic communication needs, like radio and TV, were specialty communication for typically almost exclusively voice for public safety, police, fire, radio type things.
Taxi dispatch
and a similar type of land mobile radio applications. Mm-hmm. And, well, as maritime radio, obviously kind of one of the founding causes for the establishment.
But there were a limited set of applications, and each application was bound to an industry.
Yes.
So to the extent that the industry was regulated, their communications were also regulated. I mean, there were constraints around them. I mean, you couldn't.
Yes, and the technology wasn't altogether different. I mean, ship-to-shore radio was, in some sense, not a fundamentally different beast than AM radio or shortwave radio that was used by BBC or CBS. The world's changed somewhat, but the basic technology was almost exactly the same.
Well, and the rate of change in communications engineering during the analog period, right, up until probably the early 60s when the digital transition really started to happen, for everything except telegraph, which had been kind of digital from the beginning, but in the sense that it was operated by your finger, I guess.
It was bits, right?
The analog telephone, I mean, there was a significant amount of enhancement to the analog telephone network between, say, 1910 and 1960. But over that 50-year period, I mean, that would be sort of comparable to what happens in maybe a year or two today.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's so much the technology change, because, as you noted earlier, voice over IP as a technology, to just take an example of something that I'm more familiar with, it was, depending on where you put it, was developed in the early 90s, early to mid-90s. The core standards really were finished by 96 or so. Mm-hmm. And it's really now been 20 years when we're finally making a large-scale wholesale transition for commercial use. So,
well, I mean, when you're replacing you're basically evolving a system of voice communication that had about 100-year head start. I mean, there's almost 100 years of, I mean, probably 80, 90 years of history there. And before you take a system like that and convert it to this, you know, from off of circuits onto packets and off analog fully onto digital and low definition to high definition, you want to make sure it works.
Yeah.
And the equipment to do it has to be inexpensive and reliable.
And you have to have it. And this is something I didn't really appreciate it until I worked on emergency calling 911 systems, where it is not just about technology being ready, it's also about people being ready. Because in those industries, particularly like if you look at 911, there is a generation of people who had grown up with a certain set of analog technologies that had been incrementally refined, but really hadn't changed dramatically since the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And they were quite comfortable with those technologies, mm-hmm. and continue to be.
Well, and as they should be, right? I mean, there's a lot of things you can do with the, I mean, with just the incremental enhancements that were made to the telephone network over this enormous period of time that people who are skilled 911 operators can get a lot of performance out of the system. They can make it do things that are not, you know, it's not really necessarily part of the basic Skype package.
Yes, and it was also one where, particularly in that industry, and I think that's been true in other industries that are not really communication industries, like landmobile radio, mm-hmm. Across its broad, and even broadcasting to some extent, where you often had people who did not have traditional engineering degrees. Mm-hmm. They certainly had, if they had an engineering degree, they typically had a bachelor's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got very good at a particular set of technologies. They were not really looking for, innovation was not really part of their mission.
Well, I mean, they had a job to do. I mean, they basically, the system was there to support the mission.
Yeah. And so in all of those cases, I think part of the reason that it's taken 20 years is that you almost needed a generational transition of students who had gone through college, mm-hmm. had never learned anything about circuit switch telephony or analog radio or any of these older technologies. Mm-hmm. But had learned, had taken a networking course, which meant packet mm-hmm. networking course.
Mm-hmm.
And they clearly were much more comfortable with the newer technologies, and then were more willing to make the transition.
Well, I mean, how much of this do you think comes down to the fact that, so when we think about next generation 911, and I know the FCC has been, you know, heavily involved in trying to figure out what the next generation 911 system should be. And you think about the capabilities that come to first responders from people who are reporting, seeking the help of first responders when they have a smartphone.
Right.
And it's got a camera, it's got audio recording, it's got GPS. The situational awareness that you can potentially take from the callers to the 911 call center is enormously, I think, useful to the first responders. And you also have in these networks, we have the ability to say send blueprints to the firefighters when they're en route to a yep. to a fire, where they know, you know, what they can potentially get an idea of where the hot spots are in the fire and where the gas lines are in the buildings, and you know, information that's going to be really helpful to them once they get to the spot.
So,
but before you can unlock all those capabilities, you have to deal with the fact that the cell phone, as originally implemented, lacked some of the information that we had in the hardline telephone system. I mean, when a call came into 911, the dispatcher knew exactly where that call came from. I mean, within the radius of the building where the connection was. But with a cell phone, that information was not really there to begin with. I mean, now we can actually, you know, do a lot better. But I mean, it's like you have to cross this little hurdle in order to get to this enormous, you know, set of new capabilities, right?
Right. And the other problem which made it, I think, even more difficult, and this has been true both for voice technology and 911 public safety in general, is that compared to all countries that I'm familiar with, the U.S. has a uniquely decentralized system. So you have right now more than 6,000 so-called public safety answering points, the place that actually answers your 911 call.
Yeah.
And each one of those is largely an independent entity in the sense that each one makes technology decisions on their own. They do their own staffing. They have their own operational procedures. In the telephone days, that wasn't really a big problem because they would really just be...
It was a relatively unchanging technology.
Unchanging,
yeah.
And what they would do is they would talk to the local phone company.
Mm-hmm.
They would get a special type of wire, which was originally used for operator trunks, so that they would get, like you said, the number of a person calling, which mm-hmm. they could then map to their location. And they really didn't have to do much technology.
Mm-hmm.
It was really just a small PBX, a small phone system, and a computer on a desk. And typically, technology was done by somebody in that office, typically through a contractor if they needed to change anything. But now, for IP technology, that no longer makes sense to
mm-hmm.
have individual connections to switches, individually wired up or not, because you don't have that many switches, local switches anymore. Many want what people often don't recognize is that in many towns, response areas of fire and police were essentially governed by the coverage area of a telephone switch. So,
right.
Because it was directly, this was before what was called E911, the basic 911, is all calls for that in that local area would go to one routing center for 911 calls, and that was responsible for essentially the coverage area, the wire center, covered by the switch. That
so,
really
in the early days, it was all sort of controlled by the telephone company.
Yes.
But now we kind of moved to another evolution where it's more controlled by these public safety access points, the PSAPs, right?
It's actually what has happened, two developments, namely one is that the classical phone companies are no longer, in many cases at least, as interested in providing 911 service.
Well, and they don't have the control. They don't have the ubiquity that they used to do because so many people have cut the cord, and a lot of people are just cell phone only. And so, yeah, that's what, 25-30% of telephones now, or
it's about 40% that don't have phone service.
Yeah.
So it's still the majority
mm-hmm.
of households, but the.
Well, I think in a lot of those households that do have a wireline phone, it's like underneath some. Newspapers in a corner somewhere, and it's like, oh, what's that sound? Oh, yeah. That's the phone.
It's the one that rings with robocalls typically,
mm-hmm.
so telemarketing calls. So the number of carriers that deliver 911 calls has increased because 70% now of all 911 calls are wireless
mm-hmm.
cellular calls. And secondly, you now have you don't have the local switches anymore, particularly for wireless, that are very localized and regional. And they typically have, a large carrier may have a few mobile switching centers in the country that they web aid and interconnect typically nowadays via IP-based connectivity to other carriers. So what has emerged is really now an architecture where you have a small set of system service providers that provide call routing and other technology functions that interconnect a large number of local voice of IP cable companies that didn't exist as voice
mm-hmm.
companies until fairly recently.
Well, now the biggest wireline voice carriers are the cable companies, right?
Yeah, certainly, yeah. As far as I know, Comcast has the largest number of voice lines as the largest cable company. And in reverse, what has now that essentially a large fraction of 911 traffic, for example, essentially goes through a suburb of Denver because one of the service providers, Entrado, is located in this area. And all
That's
such
a good
calls,
place to be.
Yeah. But it also increases the vulnerability to disruptions. So we've had a number of outages where, because we now rely on essentially two or three at most of these service providers, that a single outage no longer just affects a single switch in a single number
yeah,
one.
Yeah, we don't have fantastically good internet connectivity in Denver. There's an exchange, but it's a small. It's not really a major exchange. It's mostly kind of a level three pop. And there's a few companies that interconnect there, but you know, most of the traffic coming in and out of Denver goes through Dallas or Chicago or Salt Lake.
And that particular, in the incidents that have happened, it actually was not a classical hardware failure or circuit failure. It was actually a software problem.
Well, and this is where the problems usually are.
And that turned out to be much harder to make redundant, so.
Yeah, I worked for Tandem Computers for a while. They built this wonderfully fault-tolerant system that, you know, where no single hardware failure could make the system come to a halt. Turns out most of the system crashing things were software anyway. So
operating systems.
But it was a nice architecture because it was easy to add capacity. You could add capacity to a running system, which is something that you couldn't do with a conventional computer at the time. Those were the days. So it seems to me that with this decentralization of the public safety communication system and 911 and E911, standards become really important. When you have all this kind of multiplicity yep. of suppliers and vendors, you can have a lot of competition for the equipment and for the services, but it really does depend on a fairly widely adopted set of standards, right?
Yes.
So does this mean that this is probably one of the reasons that the IETF is under so much commercial pressure, because there are decisions made there about standards that have probably enormous commercial implications?
So in particular in public safety, there were two problems. Namely, one is that they developed technologies that were essentially only used for public safety. Mm-hmm. At least at this point. So, for example, I mentioned earlier,
like location,
and even the trunks. So they use mm-hmm. these things called comma trunks, which are trunks that are used originally for long distance operators.
So this is a kind of telephone line that is not a general purpose telephone line. It's something that has sort of unique characteristics.
It delivers before we had digital switched lines, it delivered the telephone number of the caller and the called party to the operator so that they could actually invoice for long distance, mm-hmm. the system could invoice for long distance call.
And this is what you call the control plane, as
control, opposed yeah, opposed it was actually to the in data band, plane. It wasn't actually, so it's signaled inside the same circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And for historical reasons, the public safety answering point kept that technology long after that had become completely obsolete. Again, we don't have operators anymore.
It wasn't obsolete in terms of their mission, I guess.
It had become extremely limited because, for example, it could only initially transmit 7 digits. Which once they had mobile telephony, that turned out to be a problem.
Yeah, the area code's not what it used to be.
Yes, so it was meant for local calls because you needed only to switch it to based on, you need to find out who your customer was, and the area code was necessary for that.
Well, one of the issues that was involved in this transition from traditional 911 to advanced 911 is, well, a cell phone with a built-in GPS can give you a pretty decent location fix. Well, when you're outdoors anyway. When you're indoors, it's much less accurate, and it takes a long time to lock onto the satellite if your GPS hasn't been turned on. Whereas the traditional telephone, I mean, you got an instantaneous answer because you knew exactly.
Yes.
Essentially, you were addressing the termination point of a wire.
It was just a... in the old system, and which is still used for landline, is a database that essentially simply maps a telephone number to a street address. And as long as that database is maintained, because people move and keep their phone number within the same location that sometimes isn't, like you said, is a perfect match to what's called a dispatchable address.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell the police officer where to go.
And the cops are accustomed to actually getting an address
They know exactly what 523 Main Street is.
And if you were going to dispatch people sort of based on GPS, you might tell them, well, you sort of have to try. I mean, you could say, well, it's somewhere in the northwest part of town. And then in 5 or 10 blocks, I'll tell you, like, you know, what quadrant of the northwest. And then maybe I could tell you the street. And then, you know, because it could take you up to, what, 3 to 5 minutes to actually get a street address correlate to.
Depends on if you had a cold start. Now, that has improved significantly. So early versions of GPS were what is called unassisted GPS, where you actually, like the early navigation devices, when you first turned it on, they had no idea where the satellites were, and they had to figure that out. And that could take several minutes.
If you're calling from a cell phone, I mean, at least your carrier knows what tower you're connected to. So they can give you the address of the tower right away, and then you can get the more detailed information, I guess.
So your cell towers these days provide you a basic location within typically a mile or so in more densely populated areas, and could be 10 miles circle in rural areas. But they also provide you...
But there aren't that many roads out in the country.
Yeah, so, but they provide you assisted GPS. So they give you information based on the cell tower location, which satellites you should be looking for and where they are. And so that has dramatically cut down the so-called cold start time for GPS to about 30 seconds or so.
Oh, well, that's not bad at all.
So
it'll take you 30 seconds to start your car and get pointed in the right direction.
It's not quick enough to do call routing because you want to reach a PSAP sooner than that. And the other problem that you have is because the phone doesn't know whether you're indoors or outdoors, and indoors, unless you're standing in a window, you're not going to get GPS coverage. And indoor location.
Well, and there's more information you need if you're indoors. I mean, the old system would actually tell you what office you were in an office building, whereas the GPS can't do that.
In some cases, it would, although that's a separate.
Where there are some big caveats on that, but somebody actually knows what office the wire terminates.
In many cases, unfortunately.
They may not be willing to share the information or be able to, but it's, you know, they have it.
The technical capability certainly was there for so-called multi-line telephone system to do that, unfortunately not widely deployed. But for indoor location, for 911 mobile devices, you now have a problem that you want to have what's called Z-axis, altitude, preferably floor level, so that you can more accurately determine
where
you
are. So do we need barometric altimeters?
So people are now discussing basically...
Because like exercise watches, some of the Garmin... some of these fitness watch, the triathlete training fitness watches anyway, and the cyclist stuff give you, they have a pretty precise altitude.
So they have, and it's only really been recently, last few years, that many, not all, cell phones have a barometric pressure sensor built in. The problem that you have is that it works well outdoors, and if you know what the weather is, because obviously it's a barometer, so it only changes a little bit with altitude.
So they're not incredibly accurate.
So they actually, in my lab, we did a bunch of experiments using a standard type of biometric sensors, and we used the National Weather Service data that you can retrieve, just public APIs, public access web type of services that you can get. And at least in Manhattan, in the buildings that we tried, once you compensated using the weather information that you had, which is updated very frequently, like hourly, we could almost always be accurate within a floor.
Oh, that's great.
So there are caveats. It doesn't always work because some buildings are pressurized. So the inside pressure is not equal to the outside pressure.
Oh.
They do that, so for example, they do that in places where they worry about odors. So they keep that at a slightly higher pressure so that the air goes out as opposed to in, think kitchens, restrooms, and things like that. There could be a slight pressure differential in those cases.
But where the technology is advancing, it's just kind of amazing how. Sometime I want to do a follow-up on this with you and just to track how the 911 system evolves. Let's back up a little bit and sort of get a big picture of the FCC. I was just telling you before we started recording that I've been reading a paper that Phil Weiser wrote on the FCC's architecture, basically, and the he wrote it about 6 or 7 years ago. It was during the Kevin Martin era. He had a lot of interesting ideas about changes that could be made to the way the FCC works internally to make it a more productive agency. And one of the ideas that he had that I thought was particularly intriguing, because it relates to the original mission of the FCC, was an expert agency. The original set of FCC commissioners were all techies. And over the years, it's changed where basically, the chairman and the other commissioners, there's not a techie among them. I mean, they're people who like technology and who are kind of what you call fans, but they're not really engineers or economists. And so one of Weiser's ideas is for the chief technologist and the chief economist to be more independent and more powerful than they are now, which I think would move the agency back in the direction of being a little bit more expert and less political, although I'm not really sure how much a single individual can do. I mean, the range of issues is so vast, I think it's hard for anybody to really comprehend them all. And you guys who have been chief technologists, you're all just superb engineers, and Julian App is also a superb engineer. But he also suggested commissioning more independent engineering analyses, because one of the criticisms is that the FCC, some of their decisions don't necessarily look at a broad range of data. Like, they may find one or two data points and then just kind of connect the whole rulemaking to a limited set of data when there's broader data available and a more comprehensive analysis.
Yeah, so, and I've seen a little bit of that on a, let's say, first-hand basis from a data perspective, and there are two difficulties. Namely, one is that often the kind of data that we would need on a larger scale is data that is just not available, and industry is not particularly willing to to reveal. I took quite a while, and this is true both for economic data as well as for technical data. So it's easy because the FCC has legal rights to it when there's merger discussions, but outside of merger discussion, many of the areas, particularly those that are somewhat newer, I'll talk as a classical example, internet peering, all the contracts are secret, and the measurements as to load and who connects with whom is only partially known, and it's known to companies. We would gladly, as the FCC, take data if companies were willing to share, when it's not like we would say, sorry, we're not interested, is they are outside a merger one. And the problem with doing a merger is you essentially have to burn whatever data you gathered when the merger issue has been resolved one way or another.
Well, yeah, the confidentiality issues are really thorny, but I'm thinking of when I read Weiser's paper, it brought to mind a recent report that Ofcom commissioned from Predictable Network Solutions in the UK. Because they're interested in Europe in general, in the UK in particular, they went with the third way approach to net neutrality, where as long as the customers get a certain base level of service, it's okay for the providers to sell added value to what I guess what we might call paid prioritization. It's or specialized services.
Specialized services. Barely none of them do paid priorities.
Well, and depending on how you define it, and I'm not even sure we can even agree on what paid prioritization means. To me, it means something like specialized services. It's not a web, doesn't make your web page load faster, but it makes your phone call work better relative to your web page.
But in terms of a data side, is
and so what they did was they actually commissioned them to do a survey of the capabilities of the different measurement tools. So they looked at things like Glasnost and Nano and some of the other. They went through like six or seven different tools that have mostly been developed by academics with the promise that they can tell you if your ISP is discriminating against particular sources of traffic or particular applications. And it turns out that in a general sense, really none of them can. Because they have to make a guess about what's going on and what the expected pattern of behavior is. And it turns out the expected pattern of behavior, you can't really verify that expectation is correct. It's sort of a theory about, you know, what should be happening. And what really does happen depends on all the different switching points, I mean, that the packets have to go through.
And it illustrates a broader problem on the data side, namely that we don't really have a good way to, partially because of confidentiality issues, partially because of just resource limitations, of getting notions of network performance, for example. So as a classical example, and this is really, even that was a novelty, we had never in the US gathered systematically and in a scientifically defensible way broad-based consumer network performance data.
Like the SAMNOS.
What became the SAMNOS, or Measuring Broadband America project, SAMNOS being the contractor. And until that time, and again, this is not, we're not talking about year 5 of the internet, I mean, we're talking now year 40 of the internet. Mm-hmm. The only network measurements that we had were measurements on university and research network, high-energy physics network type of things.
The stuff that Casey Claffey...
Basically, typically done from a university or research network vantage point, and focused not on consumer experience.
And once upon a time, the internet was just research and academic.
But that had changed tremendously, again.
And so they had to do this enormous... I mean, and SAMNOS just answers a very simple question, right, which is, are you getting a kind of service from your provider that their advertisements would lead you to expect? You know, so if they say it's 100 megabit service, are you really?
Yes.
Obviously, it's a statistical network. You're not going to get 100 megabits all the time, but you know, are you mostly getting it? Yeah.
But it illustrates the limitation of an outside perspective, namely that those measurement boxes that are deployed by SAMNOS, about 8,000 or so measurement boxes in the U.S. Measure what the consumer sees to the edge of the ISP, but the consumer isn't visiting the edge of the ISP.
Right.
That's not an interesting destination. They want to go to Netflix or CNN or maybe FCC.gov or whatever.
Well, but in many cases, these high volume sites really are at the edge of the ISP.
And in some cases they are, in some cases they are.
Because of, are virtually at the edge because they have dedicated ports at the interconnect, or they may actually be like Akamai servers actually located on the ISP premise somewhere.
Right. And so measuring the true performance is no longer a single metric for an ISP, like whatever, my ISP does 90% of the promised advertised rate. But what you see is that it might give you 90% for certain websites and certain video streaming sites, and maybe a much lower rate for others for any number of reasons.
Well, a lot of it's just distance. I mean, the more hops you have to go through, the more variation.
And your business arrangements that they did or did not make were those providers.
And network services exhibit economies of scale. So it's, and Netflix can ensure the quality to their customers because they have so many customers and so much traffic. They can make these investments so that everybody's server is local.
Yes.
But if you're just starting out in the video streaming game, you're not in that situation.
Yeah, but typically the smaller video content providers, typically when they start out, use commercial
Akamai and similar type
of content distribution.
A lot of those guys, they don't want to be in the video distribution business because it's not really a high margin, game.
I mean, the content producers. If you're not the scale, there's really only three or four video ones that are large enough to justify their own physical infrastructure. But to get back to your measurement point, is it illustrates the difficulty that you had to spend a significant amount of financial resources that the FCC is short on. You had to hire a significant amount of time to make the data right, because unlike a paper that you submit to some conference, you're not, for measurement papers, you don't expect the kind of validity in that. You did 20 measurements, you get some interesting graphs, you're typically looking for anomalies more than the average behavior, you're looking for interesting observations, because that gets your paper published. But making it work and agreeing what are the right metrics, what is the right geographic distribution, is much harder. And doing it in a way that you can do it for a few $100,000 as opposed to tens of millions of dollars has turned out to be challenging.
Well, this is the scale is a big problem with the. I mean, the FCC's overseeing the entire communications industry, and it's a big industry.
Well, and it's not even, and again, earlier we talked about how in like through the 1960s, 70s, probably 80s, the communication industry was essentially a self-contained one, and largely the only entity responsible for communication-related things was the FCC, leaving some relatively self-contained military systems and public safety systems aside. Nowadays is actually, and this has come up when we look at the White House effort on broadband one. Now, broadband and spectrum touches not just the FCC, it's the Department of Transportation because of the vehicular networks. So you now suddenly have, it's the FAA because they worry about the landlines that support air traffic control during the IP transition. It's the NTIA. It's the Department of Agriculture for funding rural projects. So it's Health and Human Services. So there's essentially, you can probably go through every single secretarial level department as well as independent agencies that have some connection to communication industry.
Kind of wonder, I mean, the cabinet meetings must focus an awful lot on the internet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even if you don't have breaches of the OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, I'm sure they did too, but just in simply in terms of ensuring things that the FCC used to worry about, or issues that the FCC used to worry about, namely spectrum and universal access as two kind of core long-term missions, those are now part of many other agencies as well, with often conflicting objectives.
So it makes me wonder if we're being philosophical, should there be a cabinet level, should the FCC chairman basically be a cabinet level official?
I'm not sure what the trade-off would be. So in some cases, I think it would make things easier, mm-hmm. simply because, one area where I believe the current model is suboptimal is for rural broadband. We have, this became clear during...
At least two broadband markets in the United States. There's a competitive market in the urban areas where we can rely on the profit motive and to bring multiple firms to the fore who compete with each other at least partially on price and quality. But then in the rural marketplace, I mean, it's such a struggle to get anything built at all at any significant level of quality, and the dynamics, the economics are just never, I don't think, gonna, well, they might someday be there as the price of technology comes down and the options, you know, expand. I think it'll be a lot closer to a profitable business.
Certainly for wireline, but also we see that even for cellular, that really in rural areas you typically only have two cellular providers, the two largest, and you have one wireline provider.
Well, but this, I mean, it's a dynamic industry. I was went to a symposium on 5G that Addis put together in Chicago a couple of months ago, and I was kind of shocked to see that the bandwidth target for 5G is like 10 gigabits. And so, which tells me that, you know, when we have 10 gigabit per second wireless networks, we really don't need wires in as many places as we have them today.
Yeah, but the problem you have is many of these newer type of networks are really meant for dense deployments and not for wide area deployments. Because if you look at even for 4G type of systems, at the cell edge, which for a large part of rural areas is going to be at almost, unless mm-hmm. you're at the water tower, or at the cell site in the nearest county town, then you're going to be at much lower throughputs.
This is one of the questions that I ask people that are developing 5G standards, is that in the rural areas, you have the spectrum is a whole lot less constrained. I mean, there aren't as many over-the-air TV stations. The population density is so much lower that, you know, it's if you had a 10 gigabit per second channel, you could cover, you know, hundreds of square miles with that in some of the sparsely populated rural areas.
The problem, however, just with physics, if you look at the 600 megahertz spectrum, you're talking roughly 100 megahertz from the 600 megahertz band. So, and at those distances, because of just the physics of it, since you're going to have, you're not going to put a cell tower on your home, with a directional antenna, I'm pointing.
Well, that would defeat the purpose.
So you're getting roughly 1 or 2 bits per second. It's just Shannon tells you that. Hasn't changed. And so you're getting 100 megabit maximum.
I was thinking about the issues with the terrain.
Yeah.
The terrain is going to limit some of that. But that's another thing we should probably take up later. Yep. So I wanted to, we've talked for quite a bit and we need to wrap it up. So there were just two questions I wanted to ask you that if you could give me a sort of a terse answer. Are there any things that pop to mind in terms of how the FCC could carry out its mission more effectively, things they could do better? Mm-hmm. And then the final thing is, do you have any advice to the present and future chief technologists at the FCC that'll help them to get off to a running start?
So one item that we've talked about internally as well, and this is not a new idea, is it used to be that the FCC itself had a much stronger internal, if not research capability, mm-hmm. but actually people who built technology themselves and were able to essentially build your own instruments if necessary. Mm-hmm. And we are no longer, just don't have the staff to do that. And so one idea that floated is that you'd almost want like a research branch within the FCC. It doesn't have, never going to be...
Well, other national regulators have something
some
like that.
Some version, although not all of them have a technical
but,
one.
I mean, the better ones do. I mean, Ofcom.
Yeah, but I don't think they have much of a true... people doing hardware and software development.
Right,
that's
right.
The kind of thing that I'm looking at. Is because what I found is in many cases, because we essentially, if we need anything technical... for measurement or for evaluation, we have to go out to contract. And it would, in many cases, be both economically more efficient and it would maintain the expertise over many years if you could do that internally.
Maybe we need to reinstitute the draft and make techies come spend some time working at the FCC. And then,
we need, well, the problem has been that partially is that, as we discussed, is that responsibilities of the FCC have expanded, the complexity and adversarial nature has expanded, meaning that when things that could be done relatively quickly now require many more lawyers.
Hmm.
And
not the key to getting things done quickly.
Yes. And so, well, it's one way if you have to count on that anything of substance ends up in the D.C. Circuit, you just need to, if you want to win at the end, you have to spend a lot more lawyer time up front. So, and the size of the agency has gone down significantly and continuously. And you need essentially a deep bench of people because you can't have somebody who does AM radio on Monday and internet peering on Tuesday.
Yeah,
that doesn't really quite work.
Yeah. And so advice to future chief technologists?
One is figure out where the overlap, like you said earlier, is the scope of the FCC work is far too broad for any single person to cover. And so where I think it has worked well, and Doug Sicker and I ended up doing that, is that we just simply because we, when he was CTO, I was there in a technical advisory position, that we ended up informally splitting responsibilities between different areas, so that he would cover certain topics that I would only pay peripheral attention to, and I would be more focused on, let's say, public safety that he only observed from a longer distance. And I think that really, and there are technical resources. You mentioned Julie Knapp. I now have also Allison Neplock as the deputy CTO, who's a staff person, who now is a more senior leadership, or senior staff, that can actually divide responsibilities and make sure that it works. The other piece that I think is an important one, that because of a limited ability to do research internally, is that one of the roles that I didn't appreciate early on, and I wish I would have done more of, is really outreach to the technical community.
Yeah.
In general.
Mm-hmm.
I did more towards the end of my, and then continued to do that. And there's now, and it's because of a maturing of networking as a research field, where people have moved off kind of just doing Mac layer type stuff in many areas, or lower layer things, since it tend to work pretty well already, is there's a lot more interest in policy issues, plus lots of what people do anyway touches policy, which it didn't used to. And so there's now actually a receptiveness in that.
Yeah, Silicon Valley's has definitely developed an awareness that they don't live in a vacuum with respect to policy anymore. I mean, that was sort of the libertarian...
Yes.
Swashbuckling pirate phase that Silicon Valley went through in 60s, 70s, and 80s, but it's kind of a more grown up culture now.
So one of the things that I talked to you about in that area, that going back to you, since you mentioned things that I wish I could change type of thing, what we, to my surprise, and nobody had looked at that before really, is it doesn't seem legally possible for the FCC to make research grants that are generic and through like the National Science Foundation. So we wanted for, this is for accessibility in that, to do a joint project with the National Science Foundation to fund mission-oriented work that isn't being done today, because mm-hmm. it just isn't really something that most people have ever heard of. And it turned out, for legal reason, that we couldn't actually, even though we had the funds in that particular case, couldn't actually fund
them. Yeah, you weren't allowed to spend the money on
that particular one. Yeah. Certain research we can do, but others we cannot. Mm. And so making it much easier to do that type of external university research would actually help. A, it would connect, because when I talk to researchers is, first 10 minutes is, oh, you've got all these interesting problems, and then the next, at the end of it is, where do I apply for a research grant? Mm-hmm. And then the answer is, well, if you're lucky, NSF funds 10-15% of grants, and who knows if the one we are talking about will ever get funded, because not everybody will understand it when on the review panel, and it doesn't get done. And so there's really a, we wanted to get research done in the university setting outside kind of a standard, very much mission-oriented research that is getting done for like reports. Having an ability to actually funds and ability to fund research on a longer term basis would be extremely helpful and really improve the ability to get things done both on a policy-making side as well as on more enabling technology, for example, for 911, for accessibility, mm-hmm. for measurement, and mm-hmm. so on.
Well, great. It's been a fascinating conversation. I wish we could go for another hour, but unfortunately, we got things to do. And so that wraps up our conversation with Henning Schulzrenne, who is, I suppose we could call you the fourth FCC Chief Technologist of the Internet Era, Farber, Peha, Sicker, and Schulzrenne. And this, if you're listening to this on the hightechforum.org website, you can subscribe to the podcast series on iTunes. And if you're listening on iTunes, you can visit the website, hightechforum.org, and we have multiple blog posts every week and a pretty reasonable collection of content explaining technical subjects to policymakers, and with as little political and policy bias as we can possibly do. Thank you very much, and tune in again in another couple of weeks for our next podcast.